Last week, we tried to summarize those long, dismal centuries which followed the collapse of the Roman Empire and finally culminated in the general decline of European culture. We pointed out that it would not be fair to say that nothing occurred between the years 600 and 1200 that would have an effect upon future time. The roots of all that came after had to be in this dark and rather dismal earth. But we do know that gradually a condition of frustration locked European culture. Man isolated from the natural intellectual associations of his kind, reduced almost completely to illiteracy. Having lost the guiding power of earlier scholarship and classical learning, found himself shut off, cut off from practically all inducements to grow. He fell into a kind of stagnation. And while exceptional individuals survived this condition, the general tone of Europe was so lowered that a revulsion was almost inevitable. We observe from the study of natural facts that there are alternations, tides in the affairs of men. And when a pendulum swings far in one direction, it pauses. And from this gaining a contrary momentum, swings equally far in the opposite direction. The year 1200 more or less marks the swing of the pendulum, a complete change from the preceding centuries, a change perhaps imperceptibly achieved, yet punctuated with a number of violent and powerful occurrences, some of them good, some of them, to our thinking, not good, but all of them stimulating, helping to break patterns and release the mind into the first adventure of a larger world. Thus, in this cycle of the Phoenix, we find the roots and beginnings of Western internationalism. We find the provincial person being forced by numerous circumstances out of the ancient ruts and patterns which had dominated him. He found an acquaintance with a greater way of life, and having found this acquaintance, even though he paid for it with his life, the great motions of Western culture regained a better and more rapid pace. So we take the year 1200 as being a hypothetical point to represent this next return of the Phoenix. And if we strike directly at this year itself, we are not very far from the very critical year in which many of these occurrences were taking shape. For example, in the year 1200, Genghis Khan was 40 years old. The effect of Genghis Khan upon the world was prodigious. Not only should he be regarded as a Mongol conqueror, a very astute statesman, a brilliant man of strategy, and a ruthless conqueror, we must not consider merely these aspects of his character. We must see in him that which he saw in himself, a man of destiny. There can be no doubt but the great cluster of five stars that marked his birth had meaning. Nor can we easily explain the fact that he was born into this world clutching in one hand a ruby gem, the mystery of which no one has ever been able to solve. But obviously the soothsayers of the desert and the far places where his banners flew saw in these and many other portents the finger of fate pointing out a man. Genghis Khan was born of humble desert parentage. There was nothing in his background to indicate that he would sometime be master of two-thirds of the known earth. There was very little hope, in fact, that he would gain distinction. And by almost a miracle, his life was spared in childhood, hence the entire history of Europe would have been differently written. But Genghis Khan believed himself to have a mission. And as Kharkhan of Tartary, he signed himself King of Kings, Son of the Sun. He was driven by those ambitions which are quite usual to our Western concept, but not so prevalent to this degree in Eastern thinking. From him descended other conquerors, to mention two: Kublai Khan, the Magnificent, and Tamerlane, or Timur Shah, the Shaker of the Earth. These Mongols, on their shaggy ponies, broke through the great wastes of Asia, bound together desert tribes and wandering nomadic peoples, forced into them one great arterial system of laws, prepared for them a great code, which Genghis Khan called the Code of the Books of Iron. Now, this did not mean swords or military machines, but ancient tablets in which strange characters were inscribed upon surfaces of rough iron. The Books of Iron gave to Asia a great document of common law, of legality, of reasonable procedure in great many details. And if ruthlessness afflicted great groups, those who came finally under the banner of the great Khans found life better ordered, merchandising safer, fewer bandits on the road, and furthermore, great inducements to travel, to study, to improve, to elevate themselves in various ways. Had Genghis Khan been a statesman over a stable empire, he probably would have been one of the greatest intellectual leaders of his time, perhaps of modern time. But so much of his life was spent upon the battlefield that he had little time, other than in abstract theory, to integrate the policies for the administration of the territories which he occupied. He did leave, however, a heritage to Kublai Khan. And we cannot but remember the episode in which, seated upon the back of a great elephant, Kublai Khan, speaking with all the authority of his ancestors, proclaimed for Asia, total Asia, the great code of religious tolerance, perhaps the first of its kind, certainly in that region. At that time, the empire of the great Khans cut through many religions: Brahmins, Confucianists, Taoists, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Christians, Jews. They were all part of the great Oriental Empire that had been fashioned by the genius of a desert nomad. And Kublai Khan, seated upon his great elephant, proclaimed for all these people absolutely equal rights. He proclaimed, saying, Let no man be in any way penalized, adjudged inferior, despised, disregarded, subjected to insult because of his religion or his race. Now, for those ancient times, that was not just the word of a soldier. It was the word of a statesman, a man of vision, more vision, perhaps, than existed in Europe in the same years. Certainly he meant what he says, because he put behind this a very strong determination, establishing heavy penalty for disobedience to his law. And he said, let any man who speaks slightingly of the just faith of another just man be penalized, imprisoned, fined, and if necessary, deprived of his own citizenship. We'll have nothing of this in the empire. So here in dark Asia of that day, something happened. And this happening did not remain there, for we know that the floods of the great Mongol armies broke against the bulwarks of Eastern Europe, that a contact was established, and it had it not been for Poland and Hungary, the history of Europe after the 13th century might have been written in Mongolian. It was a very critical and dangerous crisis. But it meant that Asia moved against the ramparts of Christendom. East and West met, not as friends, as it is true, but they met. And from this meeting, became aware of each other, became aware of the values within each other. And when the great tide of the Mongol armies gradually subsided, certain remnants remained behind. And in the blood of many great Teutonic families is the Mongol strain. In many cases, fraternity, friendship, and affection sprang up between individuals, even in this difficult crisis. And something happened to Europe also. It beheld a world beyond itself, a world it knew nothing about. A world, even if it had some inkling of its existence, was regarded as meaningless, purposeless, outside of the boundaries of hope and salvation, merely barbarism, helpless, simply waiting Europe's pleasure to civilize it. The European received a shock, and the shock did him a great deal of good, basically. It was a terrible shock, but it was an important one. This, in turn, led to other situations, and although we are not able to cover every aspect of this theory and this problem, we must remember that it was the Mongols who established the northern Buddhistic hierarchy at Lhasa in Tibet, creating Lamaism. And it was by these Lamas, by the Grand Lama of Lhasa, that the Mongol kings were crowned. It was also the pleasure of the Mongol to bring into Asia European scholars, statesmen, and even a few rare travelers. And we know that even in the court of Genghis Khan, a court mostly upon the backs of horses and of elephants, Europeans, Christians, Muslims, and Jews rode with the emperor. They were his counselors. They were in many respects his trusted advisors. And such was a precedent that continued even as late as the great Mughal Empire in India. So we can only say in passing of the impact of the Kar Khan, or the Great Khan, upon Europe was this breaking of traditions, this breaking through of isolations, and furthermore, the psychological situation, which would be difficult for us to imagine. Genghis Khan, second only to Julius Caesar, perhaps his equal, in the organization of military phalanx and related matters, moved across Asia and sent his great lines against the walls of Christendom in a fantastic manner. His foreguard, or his advance troop, when he went into battle, consisted of 10,000 elephants side by side, their bodies touching and their tusks covered with steel, a solid wall, and on the back of each a fighting tower with men. This wall of elephants moving against an adversary was not exactly reassuring, and in those days would have been the equal of the same number of military tanks moving against yeomen with bows and arrows. It was an incredible situation, but the whole world was shaking. In China, there are ancient battlefields which we can scarcely trace except by arrowheads and broken lance points and bits of rusted armor and fragments of decayed bamboo. But we know from the earthworks and from the various remains that on some of those battlefields, which are 300 miles long, 3 to 4 million men met in combat at a single time. This was shaking away. This was a movement in Asia, a movement which challenged not only Mongol political supremacy, but challenged the philosophies, the arts, the cultures, the religions of all these involved peoples, stirring up faith where it had been weak, causing men to turn to God from their barter and exchange, and demanding a great revival of faith within these areas to sustain a torn and broken world. Now, while all this was going on in Asia, our year 1200 strikes Europe in Walsall, one of its most desperate situations, the Great Crusades. Now, we read a little of the Crusades in an occasional romantic work, talking of shaking swords and glittering lances. But from the broader standpoint of things, certainly from the standpoint of military strategy, the Crusades were the greatest fiasco in the history of the world. Nothing was a more dismal failure. Nothing went forth with greater hope, with greater glory, with prancing horses, silver armor, and coroneted knights. But as the Saracen himself pointed out, though Europe send 70 kings, Asia was great enough to be a burial place for them all. That's what happened. The Crusades were motivated objectively and presumably by the great desire to liberate the Holy Land from the holdings of the unbeliever. Here was an impact of religious prejudice such as we have never seen since and hope never to see again. Here also, ignorance rode in the vanguard and directed nearly everything. First of all, the Eastern man was ignorant of the Western man. The Westerner totally ignorant of the Easterner. Crude woodblock prints, drawings, and various literary descriptions indicate that Europe regarded the Muslim at that time as a dragon that belched fire and made horrible howling noises, and that he was little better than a low order of demon in disguise. He existed only to flout his false doctrines against the true faith. He was a savage. He was a cruel, horrible barbarian. He was an individual less than a slave. He was of no account to Europe. And yet Europe was forced finally to meet him face to face by the machinery of the Crusades. The purpose for which these enterprises were created, failed in every sense, but the greater purpose was ultimately achieved. At the critical time we mention, we are very close, within a few years, to the crusade that was led by the Duke of Montserrat and Richard the Lionhearted of England. One of the crucial crusades. Crusades that come a little earlier and were to continue a little later. But about all they were able to produce was a temporary kingdom of Jerusalem which lasted 15 years. Everything else was a dismal disappointment. Most of those who went forth on the crusades, except perhaps a few of the most aristocratic leaders, did not return. Families lost their loved ones and their support. Men went out to fight in the desert, and there they died, either from the skill of the Saracen or from the natural hazards of the region. In the midst of this tremendous emotional upheaval came the child or crusade, or the crusade of the children. Two groups attempted this. Children hardly out of their teens, fired with religious fervor, decided that they would go and save the Holy Land. These children were mostly captured and sold into slavery. Nothing happened except to break apart the little tight package of European isolation. In the breaking apart of this package, however, a very important achievement came, as we will see a little later. First of all, the Crusaders, going forth to meet these savages, these barbarians, these fire-belching monsters, found instead the highly cultivated peoples of the great Empire of Baghdad, and those who had long been under the instruction and enlightenment of one of the most literate and advanced social groups at that time. The Crusaders, in the Great Crusade at the time we mentioned, came face to face with another Asiatic who proved exceedingly troublesome. And this was Saladin the Magnificent. Saladin the Magnificent outmaneuvered, outgeneraled both Richard and the Duke of Montserrat and all the other 70 princes and kings who had vowed that they would rescue the Holy Sepulchre. Richard was perhaps the most intelligent man in this crusade, and he finally came to the realization that he was dealing with an intelligent man. This was a discovery which the others had not made. And Saladin admired Richard. The men met under truce, became in a strange way adversaries and friends and mutual admirers, so far that Richard seriously considered the possibility of marrying a member of his royal household to the Saracen emperor. These men met with a full realization of their own mutual abilities and limitations. The Crusaders learned, for example, that their enemies were literate. They were not. They realized that these monsters, so-called, wrote poetry, studied science, measured the stars, developed great physicians, scholars, mystics, that they were the ones who could quote Plato and Aristotle into a Christian ear that had never heard either. It was a great surprise. And finally, when arbitration was arrived, and the roads of pilgrimage to Jerusalem were opened to Christians, it was not because of the victory of the Crusaders, but because of the religious tolerance and generosity of Saladin, who could see no good reason why those who loved their God should not have the right to journey to his shrine. So Saladin made possible that measure of success which marked the Crusades. But he did it from the bounty of his own mind, and not because he was required to by the circumstances of the time. The Crusaders, like most people, found it difficult to hate those they never knew, and also found it difficult to despise their equals, and often their superiors, in skill and judgment, and also in generosity of deeds, in chivalry, and in many fine points of gentry and gentility, which Europe lacked almost totally. Again, we find this strange emotion in man springing up. And on the crests and shields of the great families of Europe, nearly all of them, you will find occasionally a crescent set, which means that one of these crusaders brought back a Muslim wife. Also, the Muslims more or less opened their schools, their ways of life, their roads and courses to scholars from the West, showing very little revengefulness, very little intention or tendency to hold old grudges. And from the temporary kingdom of Jerusalem and from certain seats in Byzantium and Antioch, Christendom came closer and closer to the East. Trade began to develop. Exchange and barter. Out of the debris of these situations rose such world-changing structures as the great empire Republic of Venice, with its mercantile traveling to all parts of the world. Here, then, was a tying together of nations, a building up of common understanding. And right at this moment of which we are speaking, we have another interesting ambassador of various wills. For just at this time, a Venetian traveler named Ser Marco Polo became perhaps the original globetrotter. This man, who outdid Stoddard and other travelers, went far into the East. He traveled to the most distant parts. He became friendly and conversant with the ways of Asia. He was accepted everywhere as an honored friend. In fact, there were times in which he was besought to stay and remain helper and advisor to these people. He turned down many glamorous and rewardful opportunities to finally return to his own state. Returning, he dared to write the story of his trip. And he wrote the book of Ser Marco Polo. And this probably had an effect in Europe not much less than the Crusades. It was a bombshell. He described the splendors and glories of Eastern courts. He spoke of the scholars and the wonders that he had seen. Of temples of gold inlaid with jewels, of brilliant and wonderful scholars, of art sacred and profane beyond our estimation, of deep philosophies about the soul and of life and of death and all the mysteries of human existence, and of wonders of men who climbed up ropes and disappeared in the air and grew mango trees in a half an hour. Well, the effect of this on Europe was as you might expect it to be. When Marco was on his deathbed, the priests who heard his final confession besought him with all fervor to admit that he had fabricated the whole thing and had been a deceiver from the beginning. But old Marco died, and it is said that his last words were, "It was true." They couldn't do anything with him. But his book gained an amazing popularity, and people began to think of this land beyond the horizon of the known as a great and strange and wonderful place. This also, of course, had its natural repercussions, because the very sound of words like gold and jewels and silk and spices and rare goods created much desire among the merchants and the rich. And it was only a couple of centuries later that we learn how the Dukes of Medici exchanged horses with the princes of China and Mongolia and were on very chummy terms with them. Another great break. A break that changed our attitude and began to reveal to us not a round globe, but a much larger flat one than we had ever known before. The round part was yet a little way off. That had not yet been remembered. Though as Ser Marco Polo was in the midst of his adventures, two things happened right in Europe that began to have long shadows upon future times. For at this time there was born perhaps the greatest leader of the church up to that period, and that was Thomas Aquinas, better known as St. Thomas Aquinas, the creator of a system of philosophy called Thomism. He was called the Doctor Angelicus. He was the greatest scholar the Roman Church ever produced. Had Aquinas been born in another time, he might have followed in the way of Einstein or Jeans or one of the other great scientists of today, because he was a born scientist. But as he came in a time which was closely confined within the narrow boundaries of his faith, he could only operate within an area of sanctified ground. But in this area, he created prodigious results. And he began to move religion out of the Dark Ages, out of the completely locked condition in which it had descended, largely due to the prevailing illiteracy and the impossibility of a broad perspective on any subject. It is not a case of where, as some may think, the church was trying to strangle Europe. Europe was nothing to strangle, and the church had no power to strangle it with. The clergy and the laity were dying together of plain ignorance, and there was no one wiser than the others to save the situation. A very provincial attitude had complete control. But about the time we mentioned, just around the year 1200, we begin to see the breaking through of things. Part of the breaking through was done by the blessed Albertus Magnus, Albert the Great, who was the master of Aquinas. Albert the Great apparently was great of name and great of nature, but small of stature, because on one occasion when he was receiving audience with the Pope and the Pope had finished blessing him, the Pope said to him, "Albertus, rise." Albertus said, "I'm sorry, Your Holiness, I'm already standing up," which would indicate that he was not a very large man. Aquinas was quite different, inasmuch as Albertus Magnus was very much given to mysticism, to Bible studies, and to alchemy. Aquinas did not go into the alchemy, nor into these other situations, but he brought out something that was about do and certainly save the church. The point that he made and the summary of all of the philosophy of Aquinas is simply this, that there are two parallel roads that lead to truth. One is faith, leading to revelation, and the other is reason leading to philosophy. These two are not incompatible, because at a certain point, faith and reason in their ultimate form mingle again, and from philosophy and revelation united, man perfects his insight and achieves all that man can achieve. By reason, man conquers all things around him. By faith, he achieves identity with all things within him. a man between the within and the around, finds equilibrium by the balance of the heart and mind. Now, I must admit that we are saying this in a manner somewhat simpler than Aquinas did, because it took him several thousand pages of bad Latin to do it. But this is the substance of his idea. And what did it do? It presented the church with a pattern called scholasticism. And this pattern, scholasticism, was to break and overthrow the earlier forms of church philosophy which had arisen around the teachings of St. Augustine of Hippo. And this Augustinianism we call patristic philosophy. The scholastics relieved man of the patristic limitations and bestowed their own upon him. These limitations did not pinch much at first, because the new breadth was overwhelmingly helpful and hopeful. But in the course of time, and with human minds closing always around ideas and strangling them to death, scholasticism also fell into evil times and ended by a critical, analytical, literalistic attitude toward everything. It was therefore necessary, about 600 years later, for scholasticism to be broken apart in order that the new phoenix of humanism could arise from the ashes thereof. But in that time, scholasticism, which for some reason that is not entirely clear, perhaps the personality of Aquinas himself, which was a very positive one, but at that time, in the presence of many privileges and opportunities, the church decided to follow him. He gradually gained in precedence. His philosophy became the official philosophy of his church. And this philosophy naturally divided into two parts. It emphasized the tremendous importance of man's internal life. It pointed out and justified the earliest patristic ideas on monasticism, on the life of poverty, on asceticism, and things of that nature. In this way, it did not interfere with the idea of the church of the great need of man for spiritual salvation through repentance and through the purification of his life. On the other hand, the teachings of Aquinas made possible the gradual integration of man's knowledge of things outside of him. And this was important. For up to that time, men had firmly believed that the earth was simply fashioned in order to be slipped in under man at the time of the fall, so that he would not continue to fall indefinitely. It had no other purpose. Grain grew that men could eat it. It had no significance in itself. The world was made for man, and it was solemnly believed that the stars were chandeliers hung in the sky so that he could see his way home in the dark. That was the way thinking was. Man was a completely unique thing, created separately and specifically, capable of salvation, or no other creature capable of it. That man had a kind of life that separated him from all other kinds of life and made him master of them all by the mere circumstance of his own existence. Man was indeed a total and complete Brahman. The world was fashioned merely for his use and pleasure. Nothing else was of importance. The things that happened in the world were not the result of climate or of laws or of processes or of cause and effect or of vigilance and neglect. They were all dynamic, miraculous happenings of providence. Plagues were sent not by any circumstance, but by God's will. War, suffering, death were all simply experiences to test the faith of man. They had no other important value. man's complete allegiance to God was subject to a little controversy, however, in one particular. The early church recognized, because of biblical statement, the importance of the physician. And the only branch of learning that did not fall to pieces was medicine. Not that it had a particularly good integration at that time, but a certain amount of moderate progress was permitted. And one of the old church saints tells us that we have our allegiance unto the physician, next only unto the Lord. Well, today we're not quite certain of the inspired nature of the American Medical Association, but we're willing to be convinced if they can do it. But in those days, the physician really had it rather well, you know, because he was next only to the bishop, and his word was law. As Paracelsus pointed out a little later, however, although his word was highly valued, it is not certain that he said very much, at least anything of any great importance. Medication consisted of bleeding, purging, various kinds of poultices, and almost totally the theory of treating the area that hurt the most. There was really practically no general knowledge, no autopsy was permitted, no dissection was known in Europe, and the healing arts were in the keeping of a combination of the doctor, the barber, and the local butcher. Incidentally, the Caesarean section was performed by hodgelders at that time. A good doctor did not wish to have the unpleasantness of having his robe spattered with blood. He came in robes with a velvet cloak, a tall conical hat, and a girdle of gold. And usually, when he diagnosed, he sat several feet from the patient and touched his body with a long wooden stick. You can imagine how you could take a pulse through a fishbowl. But anyway, it was the practice of the time. So this wasn't doing too well, even though it was sanctified and privileged. With Aquinas, the mood changed. The way was prepared for man to recognize that religion did not prevent him from being a lawyer, a judge, a merchant, did not mean that he could not or should not read and write. Also, that it permitted him to study a little dialing or a little geography or a bit of navigation if it pleased him. He could study. He could become learned. The professor was born somewhere in this mystery and confusion of things. And the professor began to have status almost equal to the doctor. By degrees, the rights of learning and education excited men into the research and sciences. And as might be imagined, they came with great naivete to the subject. At that time, a science had no scientific foundation. Some observation, a great deal of tradition, and a little sorcery would help. So your scientist in those days had bottles in his laboratory and went out at night and invoked demons at crossroads. Those seemed to be the best ways of finding out things. And as we know, almost every form of progress has been directly or indirectly attributed to the devil at some time. This gave rise to a number of pseudosciences, to a great deal of speculation, but it also made possible the gradual introduction into Europe of the standard texts of the Arabic writers, who were very much further advanced. It made possible for the Roman writings of Galen and the Arabic writings of Avicenna or Ibn Sina to come into the schools of Europe. A man could study the eruptions of Mount Etna or other things that interested him without being convinced that he was wasting his time, which should be spent entirely on his knees in prayer. Europe was moving towards a little intellectual freedom, and this freedom was fast intriguing the mind. It was the basis of a new outlook. By reason and philosophy, says Aquinas, man can explore nature and become master of its processes. It went no further in practical form at that time, perhaps, but it placed the blessings of the faith upon the exploration of natural phenomena. And we find early texts arising on a history of storms. We find men beginning to measure earthquakes. We even find some very early diagrams of the craters on the moon. In every direction, the mind was spreading out to take hold of ideas. And this, of course, was the beginning of the awakening of the European culture as we know it. So right at the same time, another incident occurred, which certainly deserves our very definite attention. At that time, King John of England was forced by his barons to sign the Magna Carta. And the Magna Carta was signed in the first quarter of the 13th century, just within 15 or 20 years of this critical time. For this paper was signed while most of the great leaders and the great motions which we have discussed were in function. Now, the Magna Carta was quite a complicated situation in itself. We cannot go into all the details of it, but in our public schools today, we are reminded, if only passingly, that it is the origin and the inspiration for the American Bill of Rights. The Magna Carta was the first head-on assault against the divine right of kings. Now, it did not end the situation, but it certainly began to strengthen the position of the people and to a measure weaken the despotism of entrenched aristocratic groups. Strangely enough, the Magna Carta was not a reform brought about by the people. It was forced upon the king by his own nobility, the barons, those who had come finally to rebel, not necessarily against monarchy, but against a very bad king who was giving them much trouble. The Magna Carta began, however, to bestow upon various branches of government certain inalienable rights and privileges. It decentralized total leadership and prepared the way for the concept of the board of directors or the trustees, or those who must share in the responsibility of decision. It also gave to the private citizen certain rather sketchy rights. Sketchy because in the original form they were full of loopholes, but important because men gradually began to forget the loopholes and gathered and rallied valiantly around the generalities which this document contained and forced these generalities to become subjected to continuous improvement, reform, and refinement until what we might call civil law became a fact. The Magna Carta was forced upon the king. He did not want to sign it. But he was unable to avoid the pressure because open rebellion was resting near him. As a result of this document being signed against the will and pleasure of the king, even though in the original document it is legally presented in a fairly nice way to make it seem as though John was cooperating, he was not. He had no traffic with the idea at all, but he could do nothing about it. As a result of this, immediately, the Church of Rome, which at that time, of course, controlled kings and commoners, thundered out its objections, rejected the Magna Carta totally and forever. This caused quite a little stir, because for the first time, it threw religious and civil law into a serious feud. Up to that time, secular law as relates to the management of kingdoms and of states was almost an arm of religious law. Religion determined the laws by which the state was ruled, and then the rulers administered the laws of religion. Religion was primary. The signing of the Magna Carta, which was therefore an open rebellion against the vested authority of a king sanctified by the sacraments of the church, this set up a nasty situation. A situation which was far more meaningful in those days than now. It forced the barons, who had demanded the Magna Carta, to then turn their attention upon the church and to directly and indirectly require that the church accept certain reforms and modifications of policy from them. This was a delicate business, which could easily end on the rack. It was, however, by the very confusion of the times and by the circumstances of the Crusades, which made the entire situation possible by deflecting the larger part of the manpower of Europe into the Holy Land, by all these conditions and others, the Magna Carta was made to stick. It remained. And by degrees, it became obvious that the church would have to exercise certain tact, that it could control a measure of things. It could control religious life within a country. It could control to a degree the ruler of the country if that ruler was of that faith. It could do everything possible to place key men in various high offices in order to favor the various purposes of the church. But it also might well be confronted by a parliamentary body which it could not control and which could function even in the presence of anathema. This began to modernize, we will say, or liberalize the attitude of the church in the various countries and in the various political systems in which it found itself. It had to realize that it could not hold complete temporal authority. Out of this came a kind of an inferiority complex for a while, and the church began to suddenly see that it was being moved from a position of total leadership to a position of conditioned moral influence. From the time of the Magna Carta on, we see the church rapidly rebuilding its fences. We see it beginning to exercise more and more of its moral sphere of influence, and more or less avoiding head-on collision with the political factions. Now let us see in the 12th century what the church was trying to gain. We must realize that in those days the power of the church was such that it did not actually have very much practical interest in the entire question. The interest was essentially theological. The change of situations did not actually interfere much either with the revenues of the church or with its prestige, particularly among the people. Its real cause of concern was the fact that it honestly believed, no doubt, that as the shepherd of men, that it had a moral responsibility, and this responsibility was to govern the conduct of all men, to preserve as far as possible their obedience to the canonical law. The barons of England broke through this pattern. The barons had not disobeyed the church. The barons had disobeyed the sovereignty of an anointed king. Now, there was no question in the world that Rome was perfectly aware of the corruption of Joan and probably did not particularly like him or find any particular profit in him, inasmuch as he too was wasting funds that might well have gone to the church. But a principle was involved, and on this principle the church stood and ultimately fell. It would not acknowledge the right of man to question that which had been duly and properly and crowned and throned and sanctified unto God as a ruler. Thus the divine right of the king was the point of theological delicacy. And it was on this point that the anathema was pronounced and the barons were declared to have committed a sin against God.